tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with pianist extraordinaire Billy Marcus. In my experience, Billy plays like no one else, and what he does is extraordinary. When you hear him, you will get some sense of what I'm talking about, but if you are lucky enough to see him, watching what he does on that piano is wonderful, exciting, special. And given the urgency of the way he plays, it is somewhat surprising, at least to me, what a gentle soul he is. So hang on. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. As a psychotherapist, it is clear to me that so many of us are living lives that are not completely based on who we are. We may be trying to be someone we think someone else will love or hire. We may be trying to be the person our parents told us we were or who they told us we had to be. We may be trying to be what we think the good or the right or the healthy or the smart person is. But every time we deny something about ourselves in order to be something else, we pay a price for it. There's a price simply of energy, because it takes energy to suppress who and what you are. But there's always the sense when you deny something about yourself that there is something wrong with you, because we never lose those things that we deny. And they speak to us. And we think that there's something wrong or bad or flawed about us. So The Lynn Show is about saying not only that this may have happened to you, but that if it did happen to you, it may very well not be too late to recover those things you had to deny. And if you want more information about this, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Up there, you can click on Email Me, ask me any questions you have. You can get access to my book, which is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. It's about when you want to make changes in your life, what might get in your way, and what you can do about that. You can get me to come and speak to your group or organization. You can listen to the podcasts of all the shows I've ever done, including this one. And then, of course, you can listen to the interviews that I have done, like the one I'm about to air with Billy Marcus. Billy Marcus is, as I said in the run-up, a one-of-a-kind piano player. And his story is particularly interesting because of the haphazard way in which he arrived at what is clearly who he is and what he should be doing. Unfortunately, as sometimes happens to me, I managed to lose the beginning of this interview. And so we start in the middle. But I will catch you up by telling you that Billy told me in the beginning of the interview that both of his parents were musicians, his father a trumpet player, and his mother a rather well-known jazz piano player. But although he had these musicians and a lot of music in his life, he didn't touch a piano until he was 16 because they lived in apartments and he couldn't play there. They couldn't make noise. So Billy will tell the rest of the story in this interview. But given that he didn't play, he didn't even begin to play until he was 16, and then haphazardly took lessons, didn't take lessons, never apparently made up his mind until he was in his 20s that he was actually going to be a piano player. Given all of these obstacles, what he has become is really rather amazing. I'm going to play Sweet Georgia Brown, a cut from his CD called, appropriately, The Billy Marcus Trio, so you can hear what I'm talking about when I talk about what kind of a player he is. And then we're going to start in the middle of his interview. So here now is Billy Marcus and the Billy Marcus Trio playing Sweet Georgia Brown.
So I've known singers who do breathe correctly, but they studied, you know, they studied vocal technique, and they don't, their voice doesn't hurt. They can sing all night, you know. And so it's the same thing with playing or anything else. You need to learn a certain amount of technique to be able to express yourself. I mean, not just as a springboard to whether you're doing it emotionally as well or not. You have to know a little bit about what you're doing. I wasn't a music school student, you know.
Well, yeah, actually, tell me. So you get the piano, and you sit down and start to play, and your mother tries to teach you, but that doesn't work out. So then there's a series of instructors who show up, right?
Well, they don't show up, but I go to them, yeah. My father gave me to this guy, Frankie Vino, when I was in high school. And Frankie Vino was part of a twin piano team that worked for many years with Guy Lombardo. Mm-hmm. And he was a good teacher, because what I needed was some technique, not just scales, but I mean, you know, pieces. And then I kind of caught up in and out of places. Like when I was in college.
Did you major in music?
No.
While you were studying the piano, were you thinking about it as a career?
No.
Yeah, that was the sense I got. So you were just doing it because it felt good and you liked it and you got to express yourself in it, but not thinking of it as a career. So what did you think you were going to do?
I didn't know. But when I went to school, it's a series of things, but 2 weeks before I graduated high school, my father died.
Oh, and dear.
On the bandstand.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, he had a heart attack, and he was playing the trumpet.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, anyway, I don't have to tell you the trauma.
No.
But when I went to school, it kind of threw everything up in the air. And I just didn't know what to do, and I ended up getting a bachelor's degree in history, which I ended up doing only because I liked reading, and you didn't have to think that much. You could just read, and if you had any kind of rote memorization, you were in.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So,
yeah.
And, you know, I went through that, but then in the summer of 1967, I took a crash course, 7-week course, at the Berklee School of Music in Boston to learn what these chords were, you know.
So you were learning to read notes, but you weren't learning chords before.
I didn't really have any kind of concept of modern harmony and stuff. My first job ever was when I was 18 years old. I knew nothing. I couldn't believe my mother booked me. Yeah. She literally threw me to the wolves. You know, so. It was at the Cape Playhouse, which was still a famous summer playhouse, where people like Betty Davis get their start and all that stuff. You know, but anyway, they had a little bar restaurant they called the Stage Door, and it was right next to the playhouse. And people from the playhouse, when they got through seeing the play, would come over for a drink. It was a very small bar and a few tables and stuff. And one of the guys hired me because I was cheap, number one. But no, I mean, I had no idea. I mean, this was just sprung on me, you know.
What did you play?
I had about 10 tunes that I read from sheets.
Because you could read now. By now you could
read. Well, a little bit.
What are we talking about? You'd only been playing 2 years.
Yeah. I won't say it was terrific, but it wasn't. But so I went, I would play the 10 tunes, and I only played 2 sets a night there. It was from 10 to 1. And then the second set, I'd do the same thing all over again.
And the chances are the same people weren't in the room, so.
I got by, I mean, for the 2 months I was there, I mean, I did it, and then, you know, I didn't really, you know, in college there were a couple of times where I got a little something, but I didn't do anything steady, you know.
And now you're in college and you're majoring in history. Have you got any idea what you're going to do when you get out of college?
No, I was in a real non-thinking period
of
time.
I'm sure you were.
Wasn't sure of anything, and
you were just sort of putting one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just see what happens. Yeah.
Right.
And so then, I don't know. I guess when I got out of school and everything, I got a job right away playing that summer. And
Had you been studying all along?
No. Well, yeah. Yes and no. I mean, I'm very haphazard student.
I'm just so amazed.
I would go to go to a teacher for a while, and then maybe, you know, and hopefully get something, and then down the road somewhere go to another teacher. You know, like in 1969, I met up with this woman, Carol Brito, who was a wonderful jazz pianist, and she really helped a lot.
Well, wait a minute. Did you say 67 was Berkeley?
Yeah.
What made you go there?
It was weird. It's always weird with me. I read something in Downbeat magazine, the jazz magazine, and they were giving out summer scholarships for their summer program, and you had to send in a tape, three tunes or something, three tunes, I think it was, and my mother's bass player had a recording studio, and he said, "Come on, come in and you know just knock off a couple of tunes and you know you'll have a tape or something."
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I sent the tape in, and I got one of the scholarships. So that's I got a 7-week freebie, you know, where you get, you know, the teaching plus, you know, they put you up and
Room and board and
stuff,
right? So did you, either there or with Carol, what's her name?
Carol Brito, yeah.
Yeah. Is this where you began to develop that style you've got?
I think style doesn't come overnight. I think it's a conglomerate, amalgamation, I don't know.
It's one of those.
Of everything you're processing. And, it's listening. A lot's listening to other people. And in my earlier part of my life, I listened a great deal to jazz and to show music and a little bit of classical. But I was always listening to music. You know?
Sorry. You don't play like anybody else.
Well, that's the point, you know. The point is, I wasn't schooled in any specific kind of technique.
And it worked really great for you.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the good news is that you do have your own style and your own thing.
Well, you have your own ears. I mean, it's what you hear, I'm assuming.
And you don't sound like anybody else. But at the same time, it also took me twice as long because I didn't, you know, I didn't say, okay, this is flat 5 chord with a sharp whatever and a pregnant 13th or something. I mean, you have all of these things that go into, you know, the musical alliteration. And
so do you know that now when you're playing it, or is it just that...
No, I do. I mean, I know a certain amount, yeah. I mean, I know when I'm reading chord changes what they are, and I read... somewhat. I read, you know, but especially the melodic lines. I still have a little trouble sometimes with rhythms. You know.
Reading them, you mean?
Yeah, reading them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I'm, you know, you over the years you get so used to relying on your ears to do certain things, you know, That's why I've actually turned down a couple of gigs that were for reading shows with orchestras and stuff, because I just didn't feel my reading was
strong enough.
Yeah. I might have been able to do it, but I wouldn't want to do it halfway.
Okay, so 69, you start to study with Carol.
Yeah.
Are you, now you're out of college.
Yeah, and I started, I taught school for 9 months. You know, a school year.
History?
history in history of Western civilization to blue-collar, low-income Boston Irish Catholic kids.
In high school?
In Dorchester, in a suburb of Boston.
I see.
And it was rough then. It's I don't know. I it's hard to describe Dorchester, but it's always been a working class suburb mm-hmm. of Boston anyway. So
this is high school?
Junior high.
Junior high. Oy.
I know. I didn't last long. But I ended up feeling like I was a babysitter.
Yeah.
I said, "You're not getting through. This isn't what you were supposed to do." So, and the music kept seeping back in through the cracks. And finally, in 69, between Carol and other things, and the fact that I started working, and I started improving, and it was at a time period, especially on Cape Cod, which was a tourist area, mm-hmm. where, you know, if you had two hands, you were hired. You know, like,
'cause there was a lot of work.
There were a lot of work, mm-hmm. yeah, especially for piano players, because every restaurant then had a piano.
Yeah.
Not electric, they had a real piano. So I got a lot of work that I probably didn't deserve, but what the hell, you know? It's another way of learning. You know, you're learning on the job too, and then started working with other musicians. And
okay, wait. So at no time did you actually say, "This is what I do." You just sort of melted into it.
Yeah, I guess I probably came to the conclusion that I was, you know, that I started using. Musician as a title attached to my name probably by the time I was around 21 or two, you know, so I mean as far as doing it
just, you see, I mean, people asked you what you did,
yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm. And I had actually had started playing out before then, but this is, I'd say around 68, 69 is when it became more apparent what I was going to be doing. And the first 4 or 5 years of my career was up north. So mostly around the Cape and a little bit in Boston and some places in between. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of a perfect place for somebody like me, an accident.
Yes, no, truly.
You know, like, because that not only being a tourist area, but there weren't that many people playing. And
you could grow. You could work and you could, no?
Yeah, I'm just laughing because I'm thinking not only as a musician, but
right.
and some other physical attributes that were
growing. Right.
Yeah, and my mother was too around, and, you know, a little nepotism there. You know, she sometimes would throw me a gig that she got a call for or whatever, and mm-hmm. or suggest me and stuff. Mm-hmm. And when people started getting to know me, and then I started playing out more and learning more, I got hired more. Mm-hmm. And you move up the ladder a little, you know. And one of life's little ironies was that in 1974, I was playing a job I didn't like, in New Hampshire, in Manchester, New Hampshire. The place was called the Dunphy's Sheraton Wayfarer, and with a rock trio, pop trio, I shouldn't say rock, but we were playing some pretty weird stuff, Doobie Brothers, you know, whatever, and I wasn't too thrilled about it. At any rate, I used to come home on Sundays, which was like 120 miles away, or, you know, just to get away. I was being there all week and everything. And so I was home one Sunday, and I had sat in at a local club who had a phenomenal jazz pianist who liked living on the Cape, this guy Dave McKenna. He's a great, great player. Mm-hmm. And so I sat in a couple of tunes, you know, mm-hmm. and this guy said, "Oh, I like you, you know, and here's my card," and I'm going, like, yeah, if I never see you again, have a good life, you know. Mm-hmm. So, so I'm home one, just shoot back to me being home one night from this job from New Hampshire, and I get a phone call from this guy. Hi, this is Ed Desonier. And I'm like, yep, who? And he said, oh, I saw you at the Collins restaurant 6 months ago or something, or 4 months ago, whatever it was. And he said, a friend of mine is opening up a bottom hotel in Miami, of all places, and said he would, he doesn't want to do anything for the winter, but he has a little lounge and he thinks there should be something in there. And would I, do you want to come down and play solo piano? And I thought, and I said, this is really strange. But then I thought, what have I got to lose? Am I going to sit here playing pop tunes, and snowed in somewhere? And so I went down, and the owner and I just, it was like instant friends. He would come down and 10 days out of the month. He owned hotels in Pennsylvania and other places or something. But I was the only one who wasn't just saying yes, sir, no, sir. And we'd tell dirty jokes, do whatever, and go out to dinner once in a while. But I kept saying to him, you've got a little bar here, motel, mm-hmm. on the north side of the Miami airport, across the street from Eastern Airlines. And the place looks like Halloween. It's orange and black. And and it was kind of I don't know if I'd call it a dump, but it was pretty close. And it was just, pretty, that's not where the hoi polloi is.
That's right.
So I started playing a single in there, but I kept saying to him, who's going to come here? Nobody is going to come to a place like this. So there's only one thing you can do in here. You got to have jazz. And after about 3 months of listening to me yap, he let me have a bass player. And then we started doing, I sort of designed, and I'm not a designer, this little ad, one by 2 inch, mm-hmm. like a little tiny thing, to put in the paper. And the only thing I could think of to do was, put the information, tiny, tiny print, mm-hmm. but have the biggest page on the word fit into this block, and it just said jazz in big black letters. And you didn't see anything else but that word, but, that's what you saw when you opened the page. Mm-hmm. So, that and a few other things started to add up. And
you mean people came?
Yeah, and then as it got better, I got to add a drummer and then a singer. So within 10 months, you couldn't get in the place.
Wow.
Yeah. And that started off my thing in Miami. And later on, we did a whole bunch of other things that made everything work.
Like, you mean in this club?
Yeah, it was called the Traveler's Lounge and Traveler's Motel. And the other thing that happened that was pretty funny, actually, was the owner and I were sitting out by the pool and one day, and my bass player and the lady from the coffee shop come over to us, and they're wearing t-shirts, and one of them says, I know Billy Marcus, right? And the other one says, what's a Billy Marcus? So we thought it was pretty funny.
It is.
So anyway, we were having a benefit in the lounge the following week for somebody. Right, and the manager thought it would be fun if the help was all wearing these ridiculous T-shirts with double entendre things about me. And so the bartenders and the waitresses and stuff all had on these T-shirts. And the benefit was a big success. And then we started thinking, how can we'd like to do something with the T-shirts. So we came up with asking at the end of each set a jazz trivia question from the bandstand. And whoever got it right would win a T-shirt.
That's right? Great.
So we started doing that, like 3 times a night or whatever it was after every set. And, so over the next 8 years, We probably gave away maybe 7,000 or 8,000 shirts.
Oh my God! So there are people all over.
And it wasn't just the travelers. I mean, when I moved on to several other places, the next 5 places I worked or so, everybody wanted to do it. It was a great form of advertising.
Right.
I mean, we even had people like one guy told me he was in line at the White House, you know, taking the tour, and this Secret Service type person comes up and says, "Who's that?" And he, you know, what he's looking at is the guy's wearing a T-shirt that says "Billy Marcus for President." They went everywhere, and there are a few jazz musicians, who still have a Billy Marcus T-shirt, which cracks me up.
Yes.
These are like. One of the clubs I worked at, we worked opposite named people, and so some of these people still have my T-shirt. So it's a lot of fun. I mean, remembering that kind of stuff too. But for about 10 years in Miami, I couldn't do anything wrong. It was like the group was, you know, we opened for everybody. We worked with some names, but we also had one job for 2 years where we worked opposite people, and found myself the third week I was working at the airliner hotel in Miami, working opposite the Bill Evans Trio.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and then working with opposite some of the names that came through there: Stan Getz, Sonny Rollins, Dexter Gordon, Dizzy Gillespie.
Oh my goodness!
I mean, just everybody came. McCoy Tyner, everybody came through there. It was, you know, it was like the golden age for me. It was the mid and late 70s, early 80s. And it was like pure magic, you know. And I could see after that was over, from the mid 80s on, that there would be a gradual back to normalcy as far as, you know, you weren't going to be quite that elevated, especially, you know, in that situation. But
you did have that.
Yeah, and still, I managed, you know, from the time I came to the Travelers till about the millennium or a little after the millennium, I never had to ever worry about work. For over 27 years, and was one of the most well-known musicians in South Florida for that whole period of time.
That's amazing.
It is. It was.
It's especially amazing given where you came from and how you arrived at this and how haphazard it was.
Well, that's the way things happen. I mean, certain things, and especially in the arts, you know, I mean, there's not necessarily a plan for it.
Well, no, clearly.
Some things happen to you, you know, just, and things continue to, I mean, in different ways. You know? Like in 2004, when I was about ready to write everything off, I was getting discouraged, you know, with the way the music business had been going, and I got a call out of the blue, and then I ended up spending 4 years overseas, you know, in China and Dubai.
Oh, my goodness!
It was over 2 years at the Ritz-Carlton in Shanghai, China. And then I was 2 years at the Grand Hyatt in Dubai.
How was that?
It was like, I don't know, I guess it's kind of like living in the midst of luxury, but knowing you're never going to be...
that luxurious.
Right.
Yeah, right, right.
You're the help.
Yes, right, right, right.
No, I mean, I had a $900 a day room for 2 years.
Right.
I had to fight with them not to come keep coming in and making my bed up. I mean, you know, every time you turn around, they want to come in and clean up, you know, even the slightest thing. And, you know, how many chocolates can you have in your pillow? it was great, work-wise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's kind of places like that. I mean, you never thought in your life you'd be, you know.
Right.
Speaking of feeling a little strange when you... But, like in Dubai, it's totally different. It's like Disney World in the Middle East. You know? It's, it has nothing to do with anything like the rest of the Middle East. You know? It's like, it's for the wealthy.
Yeah, right.
Even the Arabs Middle Eastern countries there, the people that go to Dubai for a vacation, they're the ones with the, you know, the oil and the money. And,
right.
They can throw things around. Yeah. Say, I'll have that $2,000 bottle of wine and, you know, just put it on my tab. You know.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, but it was great for my, I mean, I never saved money in my life, but when I came back from that whole thing, I had 80 grand.
Well.
And it enabled me to get where I am today. I was able to buy a little mobile home, and I have a car, and, you know, one door closes and another door opens.
Mm-hmm.
It's true, period. There's been things along the way that, because of that, something else happened. I was supposed to go on the road in 1971 with this group. They were somewhat well-known, especially in certain resort areas, but they were a show kind of rhythm and blues. It's hard to define them. They were called the Trainiers. And they made a couple movies back in the early 50s, like Don't Knock the Rock, and with Alan Freed and all these, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And they were fun. And their piano player was leaving them, and they wanted me to come join them. They worked 4 gigs a year. Each 3 months a year. I went in Vegas and in New York and Puerto Rico and Chicago or somewhere like that. And it would have been like, you know, pretty amazing. And I didn't go, you know. At the time, I just was having too many problems of my own. But, you know, you look back and you say, gee, you know, what would have been like if I had done that? But then because I didn't do that, I ended up in Miami, and all that stuff happened to me.
That's right.
You know? And it never would have happened.
That's right.
Yeah. You know? So mm-hmm. You don't, you know, you just never know.
No, God, you don't.
And at my age, I didn't even expect to be my age in particular.
Okay, so how did you wind up in Sarasota, or in St. Pete?
My two sisters live here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When I came back from Dubai, I needed a place to stay for a month or two. And stayed with my sister Barb, and I kept saying, I'm going overseas. You know? And I was making phone calls and that. And it didn't work out. You know? So the first winter, I really didn't do anything here. You don't want to live with people forever. And I started, just for laughs, looking in the internet, you know, for a place to stay and stuff. Or rent a place. Then I thought, gee, I wonder if there's anything that you could buy for $30,000 or less. And jokingly, I went in. And I actually found a couple of bites with mobile homes.
Mm-hmm.
It was right at the time when the recession was really in full swing. And I found this place. I couldn't believe it. You know? And to this day, I've owned it 6 years. My HOA fees, which, you know, are like a condo fee, but, because I own it, you know, so I don't, but it includes water and landscaping, and I pay $90 a month.
Oh, God, it's wonderful.
Where can you live that cheaply?
No, really, it's wonderful.
Yeah, so, I mean, so that enabled me, the other thing it enabled me to do is to stay a full-time musician, because I've been avoiding the idea of a day job. I don't know, it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks.
Well,
when you've been playing this long, you know, it's just... So what ended up happening is I found a way to make what I'm making work, because I'm able to live so cheaply.
Mm-hmm.
But even by living cheaply, I'm not sacrificing.
No.
I've got a nice car. I've got a very nice mobile home. I have what most people have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, some people have a little bit more, some people even a little bit less, but it's normal, you know? So that was another good fortune that was able to work that out.
Well, and you're working a lot.
Well, especially during the seasons here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the music part, you know, the only thing I probably wouldn't have planned maybe quite the same way is, well, who knew, is I just have to drive so much to
yes.
get anywhere.
Right, you know? Right, right.
Living in St. Petersburg, too, especially in North St. Pete,
right.
Pinellas Park area.
Right, because you play a lot in Sarasota and Venice.
I do, and sometimes south there.
Really?
Oh, yeah. One of my employers gave me 5 dates if I want them for the next season in Punta Gorda.
Oi.
I know.
So that's single days? I mean, 5 single dates?
Yeah.
Is that what it
yeah.
is? So you'd have to go and come and go and come and go and come.
Oh, I've had weeks there where, you know, I was in Venice, you know, and then drive all the way back to North St. Pete. Next night, drive all the way to Punta Gorda, drive all the way back. Then the next day, drive all the way to Sarasota. You're just, you know.
You're in the car all the time.
You spend at least as much time, if not more time, in the car than you do playing.
Yeah, right.
So, but, you know, it's, I probably put 100,000 miles on, you know, the last 5 or 6 years, you know, doing that. And, but I didn't know. You know, I mean, if I knew something like that up front, and if I knew I was going to be here and I was going to be playing, I probably would have...
looked for something somewhere else.
I would have lived around the Sarasota area.
Yeah, you know? Right.
It seems more practical. You know? I do stuff like I'm working this Saturday and Sunday in Tampa. You know?
Oh, yeah?
And so, I mean, I do a few things, but the majority of my work's down this way. My old band, you know, we talk to each other, and we still start off with, like, we're still here. Who'd have thought it? Like the Stephen Sondheim's song was called I'm Still Here.
Uh-huh, right. That's a great tune.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I used to like, maybe it was Elaine Stritch or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Perfect. You know,
perfect, right.
Somebody like that.
Right, right.
Yeah, I can remember many years ago just saying to Eric, my horn player and stuff, said, well, you know, I'm not going to worry about this and that because, you know, I'm not going to be around for Social Security anyway. So I've been collecting for 60 years. You know, you can keep surprising yourself.
Yes, as you clearly do.
I think as you get into your older years, you just develop a groove for certain things, you know.
A way of being.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you can, you know, maybe either improve or not, but it's something you can be with,
mm-hmm.
right?
Not yeah.
just, it's not like, oh, I can't stand this, why am I doing this anymore? Like, one thing I've really totally changed on since I was a kid, you know, which happened more than the first half of my life, I used to be Mr. Nice Guy, you know, like, totally, yes, you know, to every, you know, yes, and just, you know, not being a, well, maybe sometimes being a candy ass, but mm-hmm. just being, you know,
yeah.
that way.
And, accommodating.
Yeah, and avoiding confrontation. And now it's like, you know, there's only so much crap I'm going to put up. And, you know, it's not that I want to be mean, but there comes a point with some things that you have to be able to express, you know, how you're feeling about all that stuff. Because if you don't, these little Pac-Man inside you start.
it's a great image, and I think it's really true. And I really do think it's all about self-protection. Some people never get there.
That's right.
Where you have the courage to say, you know, I don't mind if you don't like me, but this is what I need, this is what I want, this is what I think.
Oh, you know? Yeah, I don't hold anything back anymore that way. I mean, I do... I'm not a, you know, that word starting with a P and ending with a K. But I mean, I look back on people, even like my mother, even though she was feisty and had her other things, she and her mother came from a, I don't know where you call it, but they were always in the back of whatever it was that they were. they were always afraid, a little bit afraid of things, you know, afraid to do this or that, or, and which is odd because my mother went to New York in 1932 when she was 18 and to work and play in, you know, in a male's profession.
Right.
And she was.
So she had a lot of courage.
And she was out there kicking ass, swinging, when it wasn't done by women.
No.
So the part of her that was there, right?
She could do it. Oh, it's a way. It's like, in a way, it's like you. She could express that in her music.
Yeah, maybe. I guess that's right, too.
You know? Okay, so now, I usually ask this last question, which is, having given, my God, lots and lots of time to this life as a musician, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
Yeah, it's been... it's been pretty good. You know? Yeah, I can't really complain, you know, because... yeah, there are things that people have this image of a musician or a singer as, you guys get to do what you want, you can go all over the world, you can do this and that, and that's part of that's true. But there's a dark side to that too, that, you know, people, you know, there can be some hard times and lots of different things, you know. And like most anything else, there, you know, there's the yin and the yang. So you have to deal with the whole thing. But I've been pretty fortunate because considering I wasn't, one of those budding proteges and, you know, where you read about some five-year-old kid, you know, who's playing Chopin or...
That's who I thought you must have been.
No, I was Jerry Lee Lewis. No, I wasn't the young... whatever that was, but...
Well, you sure turned into whatever that would have turned into.
Oh, I don't know. Well, I don't know if I can define any specific niche, you know, that all of this piles into, but it's definitely a conglomeration of different things, and like you said, if I have two things that I would tell people about my playing that are different, that I'm happy about, maybe even, is being able to emotionally express myself. I just never was turned on to the kind of musician who sits there kind of like a bookworm, you know, at the piano, just, you know, not saying they're not playing well technically, but They don't know the lyrics to the song. They have no idea what they're playing. You know. On the other hand, there are a lot of singers around here who don't know the lyrics either.
That's true. God, it's so true.
They all bring music stands with them, and
some of them bring
lead sheets.
Phones with them. Have you seen that?
Yeah. Well, they used to bring in sheets written with their own lyrics written. You know.
I know.
And I could see doing a little of that, but not every tune. You know, especially if you're doing this, you know, fairly frequently, you have to pick at least a certain amount of material to...
That you know.
Because that's going to give you more freedom, too, to express yourself.
So that's such an interesting thing that you're saying, because I think it's incredibly clear that you are expressing yourself in the playing, that you and the music that you're playing are a piece. You know, you're not phoning it in. You're not just playing it because it's there. You're connected to it. And I think you're right. I've never thought about this before, but of course, if you don't know the lyrics, how are you going to communicate what the song is about?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've told other pianists this as well. I just said, you know, when you play a tune like My Foolish Heart or something,
right.
It's a lovely tune, you know, it's well written, everything else, and it's got great chord changes when you know what you're doing with it. And but if you have no idea what the tune's about, it takes on a whole different thing. You know?
Yeah.
You really do owe it to yourself and to the people listening. To have an idea about what's going on. You know, if you're an actor, you want to know what you're acting about. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of musicians who don't, you know, and I don't mean to say this just because I wasn't one, but some of the music school students that end up sounding too much alike each other, and because they take the same courses and or the same teachers. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying somewhere in the long line, Garrett, you've got to interject you.
Tell me about you being in the Miami Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's actually the South Florida Jazz Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh. How did that happen?
I paid somebody.
No.
I'm kidding. Now, I don't know. They started this going, I don't know, a few years back, and they wanted to put my group in it, which I think, you know, I didn't argue. So it was, I thought, well, why not, you know? Because we were around doing it, and it was, you know, it's a nice little thing for somebody to, you know.
Are you downplaying this?
No, I mean, like, you know, and people that you are in it, like you would expect, like Ira Sullivan was probably the first one, because he's, you know, probably the most prominent musician that came out of Miami. But, I mean, you know, it's always a feather in your cap, you know, just, but I'm not one of those people who I don't need to be showered by compliments and stuff.
You know? No.
It's, in fact, sometimes it's a little uncomfortable, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, it's great, you know, and I'd rather get yay than boo or, you know, that kind of stuff. But I guess there are too many people, and some who I work with, that are like, they're like fishing for compliments sometimes.
Yeah.
It gets kind of, and at our age, my age, around here I'm still a kid, but that, you know, by now, you should know who you are and, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't get it, you know, that kind of ego thing.
Well, it's really good to hear that you know who you are. At the risk of embarrassing you, I will say, you are, in my estimation, one of a kind, and it's extraordinary to listen to you, and a pleasure to sing with you playing. Absolutely.
Thanks.
Well, you're welcome.
And I like playing for you, because you've got good taste.
It's a great place to stop.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bill.
My pleasure.
Well, I don't have very much time left in this show, so I want to say that you can hear Billy Thursday night at the Allegro Bistro on East Venice Avenue in Venice, Florida. This coming Thursday, and maybe the next Thursday, because after that, Billy will be on hiatus for a while. And I will let you know when he'll be back playing both at the Allegro Bistro, which he does every Thursday night, and at Al Hickson's Jazz Jam at 15 South on St. Armand Circle in Sarasota. And if you want more information about how to get in touch with Bill, please go up on my website, thelinshow.com. And so, as always, I want to say that I hope that you heard something in this show that you can use, something that tickled you, or something that interested you, or something that inspired you to pursue your real self, or maybe it was just enjoying listening to Billy play. But whatever, I hope it is something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. From the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten